we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
And I'm Pride Edition Louis Vertel. Flip-flops down Santa Monica Boulevard.
Well, get that faggot shit out of here.
I just want to say all my life I wanted to be able to do flip-flops. I did gymnastics till I was in fourth grade. I did not come close. My cartwheels are still excellent. A+. I don't have the spine for a flip-flop.
When are we going to see you do a cartwheel on Jimmy Kimmel?
Well, let me tell you something. Dylan Adler, who is a gay writer, comic, who wrote on James Corden, he started doing sketches on that show, and he does like flips and stuff. I am basically just irrelevant. I can't do a single flip like that.
Well, let me tell you something. Corden got canceled.
That's true.
So,
due to my magic.
They took Dylan Adler out back and shot him.
And he did 3 flip-flops before he hit the ground.
That was actually just Corden. He said he was begging CBS, I'll shoot my writers if you keep the show on the air. Sacrifice their souls.
Drives a hard bargain.
Well, speaking of CBS, love my segues.
I'm going to say, for a minute, I thought you were going to bring up Touched by an Angel. Hopefully the latter season's with Valerie Bertinelli.
We can talk about Della Reese.
One of those people who you're like, is she still around? She's not still around.
Did she have 7 albums in the 1980s?
Potentially, yes.
Potentially. She's exactly one of those people, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, Della Reese's pop career. Just like people forget that Shirley Ralph has albums and they have hits.
Right. Well, hits is now liberally defined based on the way you just said it. But yes, they're good songs.
Well, they would chart on the gay Twitter charts.
Oh.
Okay. The way we call Zara Larsson songs, hits.
Got it. The way Padam Padam by Kylie Minogue is now like a hit, but it's on the like Barry's Red Room top 100, not the actual 100.
Meanwhile, girl, your brethren.
Yes.
Your Madonna fans.
Oh, okay.
Are up in arms about Padam Padam.
What happened?
Just online. They're all fighting, being like, because people are, you know, receiving this song. And it's so rare that people receive a Kylie song.
Right.
Because most Americans don't know she exists.
Right.
All of them are claiming that Madonna did this with MDNA.
Excuse me.
And I'm like, the gall to bring up that album in the first place.
The idea that she did anything with that album. I can think of 3 songs on that album I like. Half of there's literally a song called Gang Bang on that album, and I like about a fourth of it.
Which I was in Fire Island this weekend, and the Assassins, this amazing group of drag queens from New York, who also do Playhouse on Friday nights, they did Cherries on Sunday, and one of them performed to Gang Bang,
which is a years long song. So I hope they had a lot of tricks prepared.
But there's been about a back and forth about who invented what sound, and people being like, oh, Madonna did this, you know, and then Kylie copied this, and then the Kylie stands being, okay, you don't want to go there because Fever happened before Confessions on a Dance Floor, and she did her country era before Madonna did her country era. It's a lot of old bitches fighting with each other.
Yeah, wow. It's sounding very 47 from here. And I'm 47 at heart. I'll be joining you in your ranks soon. But also, let's just say Padam Padam is definitely better than Vulgar by Sam Smith and Madonna.
Yeah. But you know what? I do like that song on the Idol soundtrack that she made with The Weeknd.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very hard candy coated.
Right. Which is fine. An era that has aged well, and I truly did not think it would once upon a time in like 2008, 2009.
But we're going to talk about Pride and the Idol a little bit later. But first, I want to talk about SAG, who might be joining us on our strike.
It sounds like they definitely will be, yes. They got all these damn people to vote for strike authorization, like 97% of the voters voted in favor of it. And I was one of them, which means that I found my code in order to vote, which is way above my pay grade.
I found mine too. Had to dig through files and cards in my apartment and be like, oh, here's my SAG card.
No, I was like Shelby Wu going through the file cabinets at the police department looking for my goddamn thing.
Because I do not use that thing.
No, please. I pay my dues and move it right along.
And maybe that's why SAG should be striking, because, you know, I use my WGA health insurance.
Right. Correct.
Not SAG's. But anyway, the strike authorization means that if negotiations break down with SAG by the end of June, when the contract runs out, then they will be striking.
And that means the picket lines are going to get hotter.
Yes.
Finally. Oh, my God. Your lips to God's ears. Me walking with, like, somebody who is a script coordinator on some, you know, CBS miniseries just doesn't have the verve of, you know, somebody who's born for the camera. Let's get some stars out on the line.
So the picket lines will get hotter, but unfortunately, the signs will get dumber.
That's true. And by the way, we're not exactly killing it at the moment. When I look through those picket signs every time I'm on the picket, you know, they have a bunch of not discarded ones, but ones you can pick through, so, you know, so they get reused again and again. And every time I have, every time I'm looking through that, I have the same thought, which is, we need to kick some people out of the guild. Woof. Were they going for a pun with this one? I can't walk with that.
It's like, pins down? Were they ever up?
Oh my God. Pens ran out of ink? I don't know. I'm trying to be sympathetic here.
But anyway, the rules of this are basically, in the event of a strike, smaller and independent productions using non-union talent could continue, but most work would shut down because a strike wouldn't, so a strike wouldn't affect like filming for commercials, broadcast news, or unscripted content such as talk shows, according to SAG-AFTRA. But everything else would be shutting down.
Sorry, I was hearing this in the voice of Fran Drescher as you read it, so I was really taken to a sonic place.
Mr. Sheffield!
Every once in a while, you get a voicemail from Fran Drescher where she addresses you by name at first and then goes, and it's like the boilerplate recording that everybody gets. And that is so shocking to hear on your voicemail. Just like, Fran, hi, Lewis.
Yeah, like, how many of those does she have to do?
I guess like a
there's
trillion.
There's a lot of Lewis's.
Yeah.
You know, but for the special names, you know, like the, well, it is Hollywood. There's a lot of Iras.
Right, right, right. No, but her reading through, right, everybody is individualized, I assume, so.
Hi, Viola. Hi, Malin.
Just.
Ackerman.
Oh, I see. Malin Ackerman. I wonder if she is in SAG because she's, you know, overseas most of the time.
Yeah. I hope the actors go on strike with the writers. And then we all just, you know, so go on a long vacation.
No, also, that's what I mean. Like, some of these people, you know, you can expect to show up to the picket and, like, someone like, this is just a name I'm throwing out. I don't know if she's actually done this. Elizabeth Banks will buy donuts for the line or something. It's like, well, now you get to show up and be with us and, you know, eat the nibble of the donut before you go and do the picket.
Honestly, I don't know why I'm shocked, because he's always seemed like a very cool person, but they were supposed to do, Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre were supposed to be doing this sort of like anniversary show in LA at the Hollywood Bowl, and Snoop canceled it in solidarity with the WGA and rescheduled it till October.
Oh, wow. I mean, I should trust a former game show host.
That's true.
You're acting as if he did not host The Joker's Wild, and he did.
There's only one truly evil game show host.
I'm thinking Steve Harvey.
I meant the racist one.
Oh, Chuck Woolery?
Chuck Woolery.
Yeah. Okay, yes. Haven't heard from him in a while. Hope he's doing well. And by that, I mean stewing that RuPaul is now hosting Lingo and he's not.
All right. This week we have got the fantastic Trace Lissette joining us.
Another one of those people, it's like, I can't believe Trace Lissette has not been here before. How exciting.
Yeah. And then also The Idol dropped on HBO.
Expect a heated debate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, technically it dropped on Max. Right. I don't even know if HBO exists anymore as a channel.
The way they just kind of incepted you and were like, download this app quickly to see the Succession finale. And then all of a sudden, everything was warped into that app. And now I don't know why I even have HBO Max anymore.
Also, I open Max and the idol was not presented to me at first. Like, I had to click on the HBO, you know, sort of tab.
Oh, likewise. I had to find it. Yeah, right, right.
Don't you want people to watch this shit?
I think they're ashamed. The Metacritic's at a 29.
Well, you know, we're also ashamed because it's Pride Month. So we're going to talk about that, too. We'll be right back. It's Pride Month, and the Crooked Store has a whole collection of merch to help you celebrate and fight back against the total freaks obsessed with what we wear.
The collection is everything from tees to bags you can stock up. I'm not going to tell you how to celebrate Pride, but I will say that if you don't ruin at least one article of clothing this month, you could be doing more. So grab an extra tee. Plus, a portion of the proceeds will be donated to Crooked's Fuck Bans Fund, which supports organizations working to protect vulnerable people on the ground in states that are banning care and targeting trans youth.
You get the thrill of supporting organizers combined with the thrill of buying something online. It's a win-win. Head to crooked.com/store to check out the whole Pride collection. I'm really hoping that they have some of John Lovett's sensible skirts. It's Pride Month and the demons are out this year. It's still early, but we already have some opinions. Do we care about Pride this year?
Well, I have to tell you, so I went into the fracas in West Hollywood the other day. Pride in West Hollywood is early this year. And then we have another version of Pride that's more the rest of L.A. because there's this bitter rivalry between the two Prides in L.A. It's very strange. And next week we get Mariah Carey and Megan Thee Stallion. This past week here in the heart of West Hollywood, we had Carly Rae Jepsen, who did it once before in 2016. And Passion Pit was there. Tinashe was there. I believe Tinashe lives at WeHo Pride and just pops out of the floor waiting for it to begin again.
The hands are always on deck.
Yeah. let me just say, Carly Rae Jepsen, probably, I think, the perfect Pride performer, because for one thing, that entire crowd knew all of the songs, maybe a few of them from the new album they didn't know, but truly, you cannot watch her and not have an emoji-sized giant smile on your face watching her. It's just pure, you know, kitten at the keyboard magic.
Okay.
Yeah. It also sounds exactly like she does on the record and sings well. I would compare her to Kylie Minogue in that way. You don't think of her as like a vocal powerhouse, but the signature thing she does with her voice conveys well in a large crowd.
I was sad to miss Passion Pit. They haven't performed in years.
Yeah, it's been four years, they said. Yeah, he said.
And, you know, I'd forgotten that Michael Angelakis came out, like, a few years ago, too.
Right.
He came out on Bret Easton Ellis' podcast, by the way.
Tough.
Breaking news, as always. Bret Easton Ellis, star reporter.
I can't believe he still has that podcast. I remember when he started that years ago. Also, American Psycho movie sucks. Anyway, moving on.
We don't have to do that today.
Okay, yeah. We have lots of other stuff.
We don't have to go there, okay? You can stick with the Canyons.
Okay. Oh, right, exactly. Oh, my God. Remember we gave that to Lindsay Lohan? Okay.
Actually, it was so weird for the first time seeing Pride happening while I wasn't there.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first time in like 12 years I haven't been to WeHo Pride, LA Pride.
I haven't decided yet whether I'll be at New York Pride, same weekend as San Francisco Pride. I'll probably do one or the other. But,
we know you're basically a San Francisco resident at this point.
I am surprised more Angelenos don't treat SF the way I do, which is it's such an easy trip. And then if you just go for a weekend, you get to spend the whole Sunday there because the trip back is like 13 minutes.
Because most people in LA hate San Francisco like we should, Lewis.
It's such a delightful weekend trip. Yes.
For some reason, you love that awful city.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize there was such wrath. Anyway. No, but I will say this about Pride. And this is my like purest take on the enjoyment of it. After living in LA so long, I cannot go a millisecond without running to somebody I know at Pride. I mean, it truly is a giant reunion all the time. So in a way, like, as much as I always have some cynicism when it comes to, you know, the corporate aspects of Pride, after you live in a city for a long time, I feel like Pride kind of accumulates. It gets better and better in a way.
That's fair. I mean, the one thing about Pride that is always the benefit is community. Yes, you know, and you get that when you go out on the weekend, if you live in like a bigger gay city. But I have to imagine that, yes, Pride, particularly in a city, even in a smaller city, you know, it's a family reunion. You know, mm-hmm. It's Timmy Chalamet and Zendaya at the cookout. Okay.
You know? Just showed me this video. I guess I just wasn't on Twitter this morning. I just wasn't prepared. First of all, it's the video of him dancing at this cookout is from behind. So it feels like somebody is staging a fake like TikTok and making fun of what Timmy would do at a barbecue. Lo and behold, no, that is not a character from Recess. That was, in fact, Timothy Chalamet dancing it up in that jersey.
There's some other angles, but also, you could really tell that he was sort of holding back and, you know, showing some deference,
yeah.
I think, because we've all seen Timmy Tim
right
performing with a pink wig doing Nicki Minaj when he was in high school.
Oh, right. No, you know what it was giving? That John Mulaney SNL sketch where he, in a not trying too hard way, dances at the Black Wedding. I think it's him and I think Ego Nwodum is his wife and or girlfriend in that video.
Speaking of, side note, I was telling a friend yesterday that like I'm going to a wedding this summer back in L.A., my friend Kelly Carter's wedding. And he said, oh, my God, a straight wedding. I'm so sorry. And I said, sir, it's a Black wedding.
Oh, my God, that is a very important distinction.
I would put Black wedding over gay wedding for the amount of fun that I'm about to have.
That,
you know?
I think that's true. I think that's true. Because I think the kinds of like gay men who get married, they are like kind of domestic and they like things.
They're annoying.
Yeah, it's not, you know, full of life, shall we say.
And there's going to be a lot of straight people there anyway. A lot of straight people there. You know, just sort of like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They'll be appeasing like the straight people there, and they'll be appeasing the gay family too, you know? So it's sort of this push and pull. Like, you might get Padam, but you're still also going to get like 12 Bruno Mars songs.
Yeah. and that's all of them.
Meanwhile, a Black wedding, even if they're going to be white guests in attendance, there will be no appeasing the white people.
No. Also, just everybody's up in a... Like, I think something about white weddings that's particularly annoying, I've been to a few recently, is that nobody agrees. Like, not everybody's on the floor. Like, half the people are just sitting down. Whereas I feel like at a Black wedding, you're likelier to get everyone just kind of in agreement about what to do at any given time.
There'll at least be an electric slide moment.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, something... There'll be a Dougie. Depending on the age, there might be a swag surf. But
right,
yeah, you know, there's not going to be any there's not going to be any Living on a Prayer.
No,
playing.
No.
Yeah. So
yeah, just screaming while holding a beer. I mean,
yeah.
But these are my people.
It's so weird celebrating Pride this year, just because it's, you know, it's like we're back to the era of I was about to say we're back to the era where our rights are under attack, but. What have they not been?
Oh, right. No, but it just feels like...
It's extra this year. Like, why do we get... It's... I'm upset that I have to give a fuck about Target and their shitty Pride clothes.
No, right. Or just, like, the absolutely random assault on drag queens. Just complete... Like, out of nowhere, after 25 years, after everybody has, like, seen fucking Tootsie or what... Like, any form of drag has existed in front of us all the time. Now we have to defend... the legitimacy of, like, honestly, a completely benign art form, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, how is drag different than, like, the B-52s? I mean, it's just, like, it's very insane. I mean, it's just, it's no joke, and it feels like a joke.
Yeah, and except, you know, it's part of the whole thing of, you know, the conservatives have been losing elections, mostly, like, the presidential elections, and they usually do well when they attack gay people, queer people,
right.
But the regular tactics haven't worked. So now they're attacking trans people, mm-hmm. And now it's like, well, how do we find other ways to attack trans people? Oh, drag queens, because that's the same thing. Except it's not. Unless
so
you're watching
smart.
Tu Wong Fu.
Right. By the way, Tu Wong Fu holds up. Patrick Swayze, what an actor.
Perfect film.
Go ahead and watch that this Pride Month if you've not seen it. I feel like we don't talk about Tu Wong Fu enough.
One of my family's classics. What's a gay film that is sort of like a classic that you feel like your family like watched when you were younger, that in your mind it's not even like they were like, oh, you know, like we're supporting gay rights, or you know, like maybe we think our son's gay and we want to support him. It's just your parents or like other people in your family like genuinely just loved this movie. Because for me, Tu Wong Fu was always on, and I feel like my family just loved this movie.
I'm trying to think of anything that explicitly gay, like my family all watched together. I mean, like my answer would be, and this is not explicitly gay, other than one character is gay, Clue. Like we watched that movie all the time, and you do get Mr. Green being a sputtering homosexual in that movie. And I think I voiced this theory before on the show. I believe that part is written to be gayer. I think I think he took a kind of plain-spoken, like softer, more nervous vibe with Mr. Green. But if you read the lines, it's supposed to sound like Johnny from Airplane, who's like, this airplane's a big Tylenol. You know, like, I think it's supposed to be like that. Because the characters in that movie are supposed to be roll their eyes when he announces he's gay. And that only works if it's blatant.
That's fair. Okay. You know? I need to rewatch Clue. I haven't watched it in a minute, but I love
it is this mysterious movie of, is it good? Like, there are plenty of parts where, like, bits that don't pay off, but you want to be in the world of the movie. You want to be in that house. Like, the actors are all, like, trying their damnedest, and some of the lines really work. You know, the angst of Miss Scarlet, the strangeness of Mrs. White, the battiness of Mrs. Peacock, and obviously Tim Curry is fabulous. But you're like, does it all add up? Does this, like, weird conceptual movie with three different endings really pay off?
The three endings is really too much.
Yeah, but it's also like the board game, right? Like, it's just completely random what you end up with. So it's like, why not have three endings?
Yeah. Were you a Birdcage family?
No, actually. I had to watch The Birdcage for the first time as an adult.
Mm-hmm. I remember it being on at one point, and maybe my grandmother liked it, but I really didn't discover Birdcage, I think, till college.
Yeah, I remember the scene of Robin Williams doing the Madonna Vogue thing just in the abstract. But when I finally watched it, I think I talked about this on the show before, maybe during quarantine when I finally ended up watching the movie. I love the characters and don't love the story. To me, the story feels like just a half hour sitcom episode. And meanwhile, you have all these like top of the line actors, including the idols, Hank Azaria.
The idols, Hank Azaria.
Yeah. Where he's giving the same level of vigor, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Maybe one of the biggest gags of Pride this year is the Bud Light fiasco.
Sure.
Because have we cared about Bud Light? Granted, we've done ads for Bud Light before, so I cared then.
To defend the honor of Bud Light to this degree, I mean, like, if I'm at a bar where there's, like, free popcorn and then I need to drink it with something, sure, of course I would like a Bud Light or something. But I don't know. People are waging like the Revolutionary War over this because it's associated with Dylan Mulvaney. I mean, it's just a real mindfuck to another completely benign, nice, smiley person, and people can't handle drinking the beer anyway. It's so bizarre.
I do want to say, though, that I barely heard of Dylan before the Bud Light fiasco, and then it was all of a sudden like Dylan popped up out of nowhere.
Right.
And now they're everywhere.
Precisely.
I wonder if the way we feel about like conservatives throwing out Bud Light and shit is how the British felt during the Boston Tea Party.
I think about this all the time.
Were they just like, girl, what are you doing? It's tea.
Right. Well, you know what it reminds me of? I just watched that Sinead O'Connor documentary finally. And it's like when she did the Pope thing on SNL, people were truly steamrolling her albums in the street. First of all, where did you get that many Sinead O'Connor albums? How many Tower Records did you have to pillage in order to make this even look like telegenic for the camera?
It's always people buying the things they want to destroy too. And I'm like, I don't think you know how this works.
Right. Backfire. Wow. Strange.
like Demolition Night with all those disco records. Where did you get those?
Right. That was my favorite part of the Bee Gees documentary, when they get into Demolition Night and they're realizing half the records that people brought weren't disco. They were just black artists.
Yeah.
Like, enough of that. Burn that down. Sick.
Come on, Lou Rawls.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I am re-obsessed with the main Lou Rawls song. What, you'll never find... What's that song called?
You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine.
Oh, yeah. My God. With his amazing singing voice. Yes. That's very... There's disco, and then there's a very specific pre-disco era where it's like you can hear the rumblings beginning of that kind of dance music, but it's still in this lounge period, and that typifies that era for me.
I'm never surprised, you know, when Lewis is digging around in the archives.
Right. But, that's where I live, yes.
But what sparked Lou Rawls?
Yeah.
Connect dots.
Well, I will say, I listen to, of course, SiriusXM, The Groove, often, and he's routinely on that.
Oh, okay. Sirius the Groove. Does it groove?
Yes. Well, it goes straight through to, I would say the most recent song you would hear on that station would be Return of the Mac.
But okay.
It goes all the way back to like early set, like Lou Rawls.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a hint of James Brown here and there, but it really lives in like a disco, New Jack Swing, that kind of stuff.
Maybe I'll have a Rawlissance.
Please.
It really seems like the exact kind of music that like I would love to write to as well. So
it's very smooth. Yes. Mm-hmm. Great vocalist.
Pour some bourbon.
Yes. It's very like Barry White's around that time too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I honestly, if we're getting off topic as usual, but I feel like I want to know more about Barry White beyond just like a pop culture joke.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's like we talk about him kind of the way we talk about Sade, which is, you know, that's sexy. But it's this really one-dimensional take on an artist.
Yeah.
Even though he gave us Love Unlimited Orchestra.
Is there a Barry White documentary?
You would fucking think.
Is there been like a biopic? I think we need that.
Yeah, I would love to get into that.
I mostly just remember Barry White from The Simpsons.
Right. I mean, it's like a kind of thought of as a vocal joke, basically, you know. Even if he is a great singer and everybody knows that.
Yeah. All right. I think that's enough Pride.
I will be at four of them, so I'm clearly not sick of them yet.
You gotta catch them all, baby.
I'm like Betty Who, jumping from Pride to Pride. I made a joke this weekend about how I was like, God, think of all the things that Kylie Minogue, Betty Who, Rina Sawayama, Jessie Ware have seen from the stage at any given gay pride, and they still keep coming back. God bless them. And Betty Who reposted that, which to me says she has seen too much.
She's from down under.
Is she? Wait, Betty Who is Australian?
Yes.
Now that you mention it, I knew she had an accent. I didn't know she was I didn't know she was a Toni Collette. I didn't know she was a Sarah Snookery.
Yeah. I think like when you really look at her, you can see, you know, you can see the Australian.
Well, also, you just put your finger on something, which is that all Australians kind of look the same. And it's because we all shuttled them off to that continent, and then the inbreeding began. I'm sorry. That's how that continent works. Why does Jackie Weaver look like Kylie Minogue? You tell me.
But, wow. What an island of pop singing, acting tour de force inmates.
Yes. And friend to Ozone.
All right, when we are back, we are joined by the luminous Trace Lissette.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there. Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at crookedcon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
I cannot think of a better way to ring in the month than with this incredible actress. You know our guest today from Transparent, Hustlers, and now the heartbreakingly beautiful film Monica, where she plays the titular character in a powerhouse performance. Please welcome to Keep It, Trace Lissette.
Oh, thank you for that intro. That was so sweet.
Of course. You know I love you. And I am so excited for this film, for this moment. I remember hearing about it at Cannes, hearing about that standing ovation. Okay. Venice. All right. Hearing about it in Venice. Okay.
The other ovation.
The other can. Downtown Europe.
Yeah.
And, you know, being, you know, the first trans-led film to be there, too. So now the film is in theaters. Tell us about this journey from film festival to theater.
Yeah, I mean, it started actually years and years before that. I got the script in December 2016. So it took a while to complete the audition process. It took at least a year or two, maybe 2 years, before they decided that they wanted me. And then after that, it was just the fight to get funding, which Andrea has, he's the writer-director, Andrea Pallaro. He said that it has been his most challenging film to get funded, even though it's his third film, which it's usually the opposite. It usually gets easier the more films you have under your belt. But he said that no one ever said it in black and white, but he feels that the underlying transphobia of it all, or just the fact that people won't get behind our stories, was an extra added fight to getting the funding. So we had, I don't know, 6 years of that. We had Patty Clarkson come on as my mom, probably in year three or four, as we waited. And then we had Anna Paquin at one point, and then she couldn't do it. So we got Emily Browning. And then we got into Venice, which was really cool. I mean, it's the oldest film festival in the world. It's been around for 90 whatever years. We went and did that, got the standing ovation, got the, you know, good reviews, and then we didn't get distribution. So it was like another, it was just like the goalposts kept moving. That's how it felt. Which sadly was like not foreign to me as a trans creator. I just feel like it was very familiar. It was like, oh, we have to fight again. And so we got the word out. IFC made an offer, and then we did get a limited release. So yeah, that was basically the journey in a nutshell. And a lot of like, I mean, I don't think we would have even got there if the community hadn't rallied in the way that it did, if I'm being honest. So
I want to talk about the acting in this movie. It feels like everyone is so restrained. It's a movie that's not afraid to leave like a lot unsaid in a way that I think is familiar to a lot of family dynamics. What kind of like instruction were you given going into this movie? Did the performance you gave kind of surprise you ultimately based on what you thought you'd be giving going in?
Yeah, the script changed a lot. I mean, there was whole scenes that had been taken out over the years. At some point they asked me for notes and I came on as an executive producer as well. But in the end, you know, if you're not the writer, the main writer, there was two, Orlando Tirado, he was the other one. You can just give your opinions and, you know, see what sticks. But the dialogue definitely lessened from the inception of the project. So when I got to Cincinnati to shoot it, it was much more linear and bare bones. But even after the final edit of the movie, I noticed that some of the B storylines have been taken out. Like, for example, Monica had a little romance moment with Leticia's son, who had just gotten out of prison at the barbecue, the family, you know, the little barbecue tea, which was really endearing to me, but it just, you know, I guess it didn't fit. And that got taken out. So there was things I kind of had to just like readjust again after I watched the first cut of the film. And then I did fight for certain things to get put back in, like her sex work scene with the webcam, because I was like, how are they going to know what she does for a living? Like, she's been surviving for 20 years. Like, this is what the dolls do. And they were like, no. Okay, we'll show it to some people. We hear you. And then they put it back in. So it's collaborative in that way. But what I also realized is that because it was so zoomed in, literally zoomed in with the aspect ratio 1.2:1, like the performance was amplified in a way that I couldn't run from it at all. And there was no phoning it in. There was no, you know, there was no ABCing it. Like, it was all internal and had to be really, really real. So in some ways, I feel like it was a really wonderful challenge as an actor.
Mm. Well, I have to wonder too, just about, you know, you mentioned the aspect ratio and it being so zoomed in on your performance, your face. And I feel like you're in the unique position, you know, where you come from ballroom, you know, mm-hmm. So, and you've walked face before, you know, so.
For 20 years.
That like? Yes. What is that like? Like, you were literally walking in a category where you're serving face, and now you're an actress. You know, I feel like you've had more of like the face close up, you know, even practice than most people getting in front of a camera.
That's so funny, because they're like, they couldn't be further apart if you think about it. I mean, when I'm acting, the last thing I'm thinking about is like, what my hair is doing or what my face mm-hmm. is doing. Because if I was thinking about that, I don't think it would look very good. I mean, it wouldn't look very real or authentic. So I think, though, having been a face queen from the ballroom scene, I already got that validation, right? Mm. So I was able to put that down. I didn't need to bring that with me to my acting. And I learned that a long time ago in acting class, like, you're going to be what you're going to be. Like, I'm never going to be the 20-something hot starlet. I'm never going to be Zendaya. I'm never going to be her, no matter how pretty I am, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I leave that at the door and I focus on the work, the truth, and the heart, maybe I can touch people's lives. Maybe this story can be lauded in other ways. It might not be the most heavily watched film of the year, but maybe it'll do well critically. Maybe it'll reach some people and change some hearts and some minds and affect change, you know, affect people's kind of like innocently ignorant thoughts about trans people, which I feel like there's a lot of that flying around. Like, there's definitely willful ignorance in this country, but I feel like a lot of it is very just because they don't know us. So, but thank you for that. For that compliment. I mean, I'm assuming you think that, you know, the face card was approved.
Never decline. Okay.
But I really was, I wasn't even wearing makeup for like 90% of the movie. So I did my best to just not even worry about that. Like, I had to be in the heart of it all. But yeah.
You talked about how you stuck up for the video sex work part of your character's storyline in the movie. Is it fun or also frustrating to have to kind of voice what the reality of this character would be to, you know, non-trans colleagues? Is it like, is that a fun part of the job? Is that the frustrating part of the job?
I would not say it's a fun part of the job. It's just part of collaboration. And when you are the lone trans soldier in the room, sometimes that's just what you have to do. And there was one other trans woman on the production. Her name was Drew Gregory. And she was able to kind of I was able to bounce things off of her. And at times she was able to kind of back me up. The good news is that, like, we were working with really wonderful people, wonderful cis people. So, you know, I mean, sure, it's, I mean, in a perfect world, maybe there would be like 5 or 6 trans people on set and that, you know, we wouldn't have even had to have that conversation. But I guess on the bright side, it's like they welcomed the collaboration. Doesn't mean it wasn't a fight sometimes, but I knew Monica deserved it. I knew the dolls deserved it. To really see ourselves and our journey. And I knew I wasn't dealing with unreasonable people, and I knew that they wanted the story to be the best it could be as well. And so in the end, they ended up like thanking me and thanking Drew because it made for a better product.
Mm. It's so beautiful hearing you talk about the film, you know, talk about what it'll mean, you know, for other trans women to see this as well. And, you know, just for our community in general. And I wonder, when you're like not focused on everything that you got to get out with this film and promoting it and stuff, like, what shit does like Trace like to watch? Like, what do you enjoy? And sort of what would you love to see, you know, in a perfect world where you don't always have to make a film like Monica, you know, like you get to do another film where you're just existing and having fun. Like, what kind of genre do you want that to be?
Oh, I love that question. I fantasize, well, I actually wrote a series back in 2016 with my good friend Devere Rogers, and we sold
love
it
Devere.
To SF. Yeah, you know Devere.
Yes,
okay, yeah. So, yeah. He's gonna be in that new Issa Rae movie. You know, we sold it to FX. I think I can talk about this. I don't know. If I'm not, please don't get me sued. Like, I don't know. You guys probably know the legalities of it better than I do. But we sold it to FX. It was in development for like, I don't know, a year and a half. And then it didn't get greenlit. And so it was a show just about chosen family and friends. And it was very urban. It was very like, I guess, semi-autobiographical about my 20s experience. That I pulled from like New York when I was dancing in the strip clubs, kind of living this semi-stealth life where I wasn't, you know, I was compartmentalizing and just living parts of my life where I didn't talk about being trans, like at my job or whatever. But the tone of it was like the genre, back to your question, the genre was very similar to like Insecure, Atlanta, even Girls a little bit, like, it's just very slice of life with friends. And I don't know, that really witty current comedy that is mixed with drama. I mean, that would be like a series like that would be a dream. I also have like Marvel dreams because I want to do action someday while I can still, you know, pull a back handspring or whatever, like, you know, while I'm still limber, while a bitch is still limber, I want to get my rogue on. But you know, those gates are hard to get into, so I'll take what I can get. But I do dream about like all different genres. I mean, I was basically naked and crying the whole time in Monica, so I'm really open to other things.
That's not the dream right there.
No, it's part of it. I mean, it's all part of it. Like,
a couple of years ago, you were part of that documentary Disclosure, which I feel like should be heralded as much as like the celluloid closet is for like queer people in cinema history. That documentary is fucking excellent. I was wondering what your experience working on it was, because I mean, going into it, I wouldn't, if I were you, I don't know that I would have been able to predict it would be such a fucking good movie. It's so good.
It's really good. I mean, not to be Debbie Downer, but I was disappointed that it didn't get a nomination for, I don't know. It just didn't get the critical recognition I feel like it deserves, because it's really solid and it's such an index for people to use. Like, if you're going to make something, anything with trans people in it, you absolutely have to watch that documentary. I think everyone should watch it. Just, you know, I think they should show it in school. I think they do actually now in some schools. But making it was cool. I just showed up one day at, what was the name of that studio? Stack It? I forget. It's in LA. I showed up and yeah, I chatted for like probably 2 hours. And so there's so much more. I mean, they could probably make a part two and three if they wanted to, because I think I ended up in like 10 minutes of it. But, you know, the stories that everyone had were incredible. And I mean, it was beautifully shot. Sam Fetter is a friend of mine. I was actually involved in the first version of it, which they used to then go and get funding. So they have more footage of me from like, I don't know, 10 years ago as well.
Yeah, no, I remember watching it too and just being like, not just like for, not just, you know, for people who like don't know any queer people needing to watch it, like just for queer men, Lewis and I watching it, you know, like it was just like learning more things about everyone else in our community. I felt like it was really, really good. So
yeah, very thorough. Yeah. Yes.
Very thorough. Yeah. Yeah. Sam and Laverne, they did an amazing job.
I want to switch gears a bit too and talk about your experience in Hustlers, you know, which is such a wild moment that I feel like that happened. And it was such a big lightning bolt for a moment for like that. I feel like the J-Lo of it all.
Yeah.
But now it almost feels like, you know, I feel like Hustlers should be in the conversation a bit more. I feel like everyone who was in it too was fantastic. You were fantastic in it. And I just felt like that's another thing where I feel like there's this collection of women in this great film. And I was like, well, then now put them in everything.
Yeah, I know. I know. These are questions for the studio heads. listen, it was a good film. It did well at the box office. I mean, Kiki's working her ass off. I'm sure, you know, J-Lo and Lily, they're fine. I'm waiting for my next gig, which doesn't feel great having a critically acclaimed movie out, but we're also striking, so there's that.
Mm-hmm.
I adore Laureen Scafaria, the director writer, and she's a friend of mine now. And she actually took me to dinner like a couple weeks ago to celebrate Monica, like with me and my friends, which I thought was just so, she's so generous and kind. Yeah, she still looks out for me. She still wants to work together again. So maybe we'll do something in the future. She's working on her Bee Gees documentary, or not Bee Gees feature right now. So,
a feature on the Bee Gees?
Yeah.
Oh, I need to see that. I love
the Bee Gees. It's in the works. She's been working hard on it. So, but yeah, she's amazing. Like she's an example of like, not just an ally, but someone who has become a friend, like a real friend. And I don't know, Hustlers was a dream, but I can't help but wonder, like, if I was cis and I was in a movie like Hustlers, like, wouldn't I have went on to do like Euphoria after that or something? I don't know. I just feel like I probably would have blown up. And so, you know, once again, I'm left with questions about like what it means to be trans in this business, because I just feel like it's always a fight.
And I'm sure you feel like you're always waiting on people like Laureen Scafaria, like who are like way radder than average, you know?
Right. Right. We have to find our champions, and that even that feels exhausting, because at some points in my career, I'll speak for myself, you're like, oh, but I've done the thing. Like I've done the blockbuster. I've done the critically acclaimed TV series that won Emmys and Golden Globes. I've done the indie darling. What else does a bitch have to do before she's got options, you know? And there's not near a script on my desk right now. So I'm just like, you know, kind of it sucks to be a pioneer. It sucks. I mean, it's beautiful in a lot of ways. Like, maybe the legacy will be great, but like, I would be lying if I said I don't wake up every day like a little bit exhausted by some of it. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, being ahead of the curve means you're ahead.
I didn't expect to be this angry on your podcast.
We're angry all the time, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You didn't catch us on like a nice episode. Please, don't worry.
No, listen. We don't want, you know, the Halle Berry playing Dorothy Dandridge and introducing Dorothy Dandridge of the Trace Lissette life. Okay, we want Trace Lissette introducing herself.
Okay, bury that.
Well, let me tell you, the movie is beautiful. I'm happy for you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Patricia's amazing, and she's such a riot. I mean, she was the sick and dying in the movie, but off camera, I mean, you know, offset, she was kikiing with me at the bar, like just total grandam, like old Hollywood, like hilarious. They call her Party Clarkson. So she's really...
Now that means I will be calling her Party Clarkson. All right. Yeah. From here on out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just so nice to walk. I live in the Village now, so it's like nice to walk past IFC and see your face outside.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, that, oh God, what a full circle moment. We did our New York premiere there, and I mean, I've been pretty open with my history of being a sex worker in the Village in the early 2000s, and the fact that we just happened to premiere there and that it's been playing there and the girls are kind of falling in to see it is like, oh, melts my heart. So that was a really special moment for me.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being here, Trace.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my God, anytime.
You're amazing.
Yes. We'll have you back when you are dazzling the screen
when I'm again. Rogue.
Yes, well, you're Rogue, okay?
Get the silver streak going now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Who's your Gambit? Okay. Who's playing Gambit when you're Rogue?
Who's playing Gambit?
Who's playing Gambit? Who do you want to make out with on screen?
Kingsley Benadire from
okay. Oh, sure. Oh my God, he's so gorgeous. Yeah. Yes, he'll be he's in the Barbie movie coming up.
Woo! Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he is. He gets me going.
Done.
All right. Well, that's it.
All right. Thank y'all so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Trace. That was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there. Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
Well, we finally locked Crooked's intimacy coordinator in the bathroom, so we're ready to talk about the premiere of The Idol. After hearing all the horror stories during production and seeing some brutal reviews, we're diving into the first episode. Lewis, I've got cum on my face. How about you?
Guys, I have bad news. So this is like the lowest rated show in HBO history. And so I went in, you know, expecting to see, you know, a bunch of newish actors kind of being amateur. My favorite thing, pop stars attempting to act. We can go down the history of how dubious that road has been and how surprisingly successful some people have been on that track. I thought the episode was kind of good.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
I would love to know. I thought they set up, so Lily Rose Depp plays this huge pop star, and she's surrounded by this coterie of handlers and stuff who are all cynical and self-interested, ultimately, but saying things all the time, like philosophizing about how, like, yeah, this is a good comeback for her, and, you know, constantly spinning a narrative about this person who's named Jocelyn, which is a baffling name for a pop star. Jocelyn just feels like a minor character in like the Babysitter's Club or something.
It's like Mabel.
Yeah, Mabel, right.
It's like Mabel, Nene Cherry's daughter.
Yes. Also, Tracy Ullman's daughter. Anyway, so I expected it to be an amateurish production. I was set up for it to fail. Maybe it's just I was set up for it to fail. But I thought Lily Rose Depp was really good. I thought specifically as somebody who is a successful pop star, and you see why she's so cynical, because she sees through the people around her, and yet she has to have those people around her. So in a way, her life sucks.
Yeah. Here's my thing. First of all, I think Sam Levinson should be tried in The Hague.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't need him. I need Interpol to deal with that. I'm not saying I don't.
The dialogue, just from jumping off the bat, it's sort of that like pseudo like, oh, this is really cool dialogue that I feel like I would always get in grad school from people who loved a lot of Tarantino, you know, and they're like, oh, you know, this is going to be slick, this is fun, you know, stuff like mental illness is sexy, you know, or like.
That is the worst part of the episode. This woman handler who is talking about Jocelyn as she's doing this racy photo shoot. And is justifying the way they're framing her for her upcoming era. And she says, yeah, if you're living in Ohio, you don't know somebody like her. She's not dating your best friend. She's not doing this. So that's why mental illness is sexy. And it's really on the nose.
Demented.
Yeah.
If mental illness were sexy, I'd find Sam Levinson a lot hotter. And listen, I also want to say that the thing about this series for me is that it feels very regressive in the way that we think about pop music, right? I just sort of can't imagine a current pop star who really is sort of like, I hate my life and my handlers and everyone surrounding me. It feels very of the Britney era and maybe a bit of like what we were getting in the like the Selena Gomez documentary. But even that was like, she didn't hate her handlers. She was dealing with her mental illness and hated a lot of the shit that she had to do, which she just sort of wanted to sing. But even this, like, she seems to like think her songs are whack and corny and not even like her music. And I'm like, who is that? Like, who as a pop star in this era is just sort of like doing pop music and shit like that, but not loving it and not sort of like even having like fun with it?
I concur. To think of somebody that disempowered, like, that doesn't remind me of, like, a Dua Lipa, or that doesn't remind mm-hmm. me of any of the other big people hanging around, except Ariana Grande has denounced some of her old music. So I kind of do wonder if it's maybe a parallel with her career.
Yeah, I mean, The Weeknd does know Ariana very well. The Weeknd was also involved with Selena Gomez, so maybe there are some, you know, connections with that, but I don't know. It seemed very like trying to be too much for the sake of being too much. You know, I don't know what story we're telling here.
I would also say, like, maybe that's a little bit too cliched too. Like an old idea of what we think about a pop star, like, you know, oh, they're toiling and working very hard and, you know, and to what end? And they're not artistically satisfied. And they're basically a piece of meat being hustled through photo shoots and choreography.
I mean, listen, I like the acting. I really like a lot of the side people in it.
What do you think of Abel's acting?
I don't like that.
I was pretty amused that he was talking so much about When Doves Cry in Prince, because his performance to me was giving Prince in roughly Graffiti Bridge.
I'm loving all of the side characters. I'm loving Rachel Sennett. I'm loving Dan Levy getting to do something different. Hank Azaria is wilding out in this. Lily Rose Depp's amazing.
I'm actually surprised how realistic Dan Levy is. He really does feel like that, like, overly smart, like, kind of bitchy person who's there to spin the narrative about this person's career and lightly take issue and umbrage with the with everybody else trying to run the operations.
Right. I found the aside of Hari Duff's introduction very funny because it felt very realistic, at least to things I've experienced in life. You know, like the person, the Dan Levy character introducing her and being like one of the best pop culture writers. You know, just like saying something stupid like that. Like that's what was said. Like when I was introduced to Travis Scott and Kylie Jenner, I'm like, they don't care about this.
Yeah,
I'm like,
right.
I write profiles.
Yeah, and also, only the best. Yeah, bring me Gay Talese, said Kylie Jenner. Hari Duff styled very much like one of my favorite pop stars of all time, Kathy Dennis, by the way. Please look up her album, Move to This.
Is it music you can actually move to, though, Lewis?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Especially if you wear a little black cat suit like Kathy Dennis.
Mostly, I'm just thinking of this in terms of Euphoria. And I get, like, Euphoria at least makes sense because it's very kids, it's very Skins, you know. It's like, we've seen that in Gossip Girl. We've seen that in high school, you know. Like, and at least it's telling Zendaya's story at first, and then it's branching out and telling all these other stories. But I think about the idol is it seems completely uninterested in its main character.
Meaning what?
It doesn't seem interested in, like, her journey or anything. It seems like a story is being told about this woman being corrupted, you know, by this man she's meeting. But, like, she seems to have no agency in the story either.
Right. Yeah, everything sort of just happens to her. This is a situation similar to the movie Blonde.
It's very Blonde, the TV show.
Yeah.
So
I actually am surprised that that parallel works out. I think that is kind of true. It's not as, like, violent and there aren't as many unbelievably vile scenes. The pilot ends with one scene that is concerning on purpose, but not to the level that Blonde was.
You mean that Michael Myers scene at the end?
Yes.
Breathing through the sweater. And like, what am I watching here? And then it just ends.
It was giving edgy for edgy's sake. That said, I do think they set up well why someone like her would turn to somebody like him, because she values that he comes from a completely different place than the people who she's surrounded with every day. And so any sort of real personality she gets from him, she really values, because she doesn't get an ounce of that from, you know, Dan Levy being on his phone and being concerned about her latest PR imbroglio.
Of course. Yeah. I don't know. I still just think it's very weird, you know, to have sort of like a pop series about a pop idol from like a straight man, you know?
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, what are we doing here?
Yeah. Does he get it ultimately? Yeah. Right. Is this coming from a pop fan? It doesn't feel like it.
So, ultimately for me, it's a thumbs down.
A tentative thumbs up for me, but I also kind of just wish it were a movie. Like if it ended with them, you know, forming this really toxic relationship and then that was that, that would be a complete story to me. I don't know how this is going to sustain however many episodes it needs to.
It's Bonnie and Clyde, baby. They're just going to start killing people.
Faye Dunaway showing up in this show would be a gag. That I would love.
I also want to shout out Divine Joy Randolph.
Oh, yes. Fabulous.
Yes. She is so funny. And I miss her from like High Fidelity. So I'm glad that she's working.
Yes. No, she's really good in this episode, too.
I'm glad everyone in this is working and collecting a check. That's all I have to say.
Again, Lily Rose Depp, better than I would have expected.
Yeah.
Love her mom, Vanessa Paradis. I don't remember who her father is.
Yeah. Unknown actor.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not everybody makes it in this business.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis.
My Keep It is a simple one. My Keep It is to people who wrote quote-unquote obituaries for a beloved icon, Tina Turner, that said this, whether it was on Facebook, whether it was on Twitter, whether it was on Snapchat, wherever, Tina Turner, simply the best. Guys, we all know she sang that song. Yes, of course. Not saying she wasn't the best. Can you spend more than 1.5 fucking seconds on a post about somebody who was so fucking amazing? There's like, you can't even call any one part of her career the definitive part. They're all so amazing. I've talked before on the show how I'm obsessed with the song Typical Male. The Private Dancer album is fabulous. If you don't know I Can't Stand the Rain, you probably are familiar with that song as a sample on Super Duper Fly by Missy Elliott. There's any era. The music with Ike, obviously, even though you don't want to bring up Ike. Plenty to say. But it's truly like if Michael Jackson died, you said, Michael Jackson, beat it. That just like, what? Anything else? Please. It's that syndrome of we're in this world of we celebrate icons so hard on Twitter and we celebrate it for like likes and retweets. But sometimes it feels like no one actually knows anything. It's that Dolly Parton thing of, I know you know Jolene and I know you know 9 to 5 and I Will Always Love You. Time to pick a fourth song now, and I don't think you can do it. So I was like, now someone call what I'm doing gatekeeping. I'm saying what it is no literally any fucking thing. Literally, if you're going to jump into the conversation, be able to have the conversation.
I think it's also symptomatic of this whole needing to get out there that you are a part of the conversation, that you are also grieving too, that you also, quote unquote, get it. Like, yeah. Just tweeting out Tina Turner, simply the best. It's like, now people know that you, like, you felt sad about it. And it's like, did you feel sad about it? You can't have felt that sad about it if you were one of the first people to tweet out Tina Turner, simply the best.
Yeah.
It just popped into your brain, you did it, and then you went about your day.
It's not considered. Yes. I like the people who took a beat, listen to their favorite songs again. I'm partial to the album Break Every Rule. We could do an entire episode about Tina Turner. I mean, it's just it's crazy how much she brought. And also, it's like in the documentary we got about her recently, she basically foreshadowed her own death. Like, she made her final trip to the States before going back to Switzerland, and kind of alluded to a mysterious illness. If we're talking about the greatest women in rock and roll history, I think it would definitely be Aretha Franklin, Tina Turner, Janis Joplin, Madonna, in any order. I mean, you pick where they belong. Yeah, Joni Mitchell's up there too. Maybe Bonnie Raitt.
Now, we didn't get to talk that much about Tina, obviously, because we're off last week. But, you know, you should listen to our episode where we talk about the documentary. We talked about it with Aida in 2021 when that came out. But underrated song that I've been listening to lately, Goldeneye.
Oh, please.
And I don't think many people have been like talking about Goldeneye, to be honest. But I was thinking of Bond songs recently because I also saw the drag queen Busted in Cherry Grove while in Fire Island this weekend, and she did Carly Simon's Nobody Does It Better. And so, please. I got on this whole Bond song kick, and Goldeneye, written by my man Bono.
That is crazy that he wrote that song.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like him at all. Nothing about that song reminds me of you too. Also, that I think is the last Bond theme to go full throttle Bond theme. I mean, like, you had ones afterwards that were like The World Is Not Enough, that sort of rises to epic. And obviously we're in this lethargy era with Skyfall, Writings on the Wall, No Time to Die. But that was the last one that felt like it belonged to like a Shirley Bassey, Tom Jones version of a Bond theme.
Yeah, I mean, I love Sheryl Crow, but Tomorrow Never Dies is really not memorable.
That's getting a little soupy, you know what I'm saying? It's getting out of the lightning and into the soup.
And let us not forget Die Another Day, which is...
barely a song. God love her. I kind of like the song.
It's a Gregorian chant.
Yes. I'm sure I brought this up before. That was in the Kazaa era when that came out, and I remember downloading a version of that song that didn't have the vocals yet in it. And the vocals are basically an instrument in that song. It like just sounds blank without it. I truly thought Madonna had lost her mind. Like that. So I was like, this song doesn't sound complete. It doesn't like somebody produced it. Anyway.
And little did you know.
20 years later, we're having the same conversation, if you know what I mean.
we did mention this in the Idol conversation, but I like her new song on the Idol soundtrack. I will say the music in the Idol is great. So,
yes. Oh yeah, we got some Prince at the end there, didn't we?
Yeah. So,
and Like a Prayer was played in the middle of the episode too. Oh, and I'm tying it all together because Madonna did a song with The Weeknd for the show. Okay, yeah. So they probably did a little deal there. Okay.
Yeah, and let me tell you something. If there's one thing The Weeknd knows, it's music. Let's go back to that.
All right. Yeah, get back to the Super Bowl.
You need to get back in the studio.
You're your own Jocelyn. Yes. Ira, what's your keep it this week?
My keep it this week goes to viewers of the Succession finale. Not all of them.
Okay.
But in the wake of the show ending, it seems like a lot of people didn't know what the fuck they were watching.
Meaning what?
So, you know, the finale happened last week and we were off. So let me just sort of recap this for everyone. The siblings band together to try and take control of their father's company with a vote. And Kendall sort of tells his brother Roman and sister Shiv that he is the only one who can sort of run the company, you know? He is the only one who can run the company because Shiv has a lot going on with basically being a woman. Yes. And Roman embarrassed himself at their father's funeral. So he's like, it has to be me. And we always knew he was always going to say it has to be him. But, you know, he comes up with this reasoning. And then at the last minute, Shiv changes her vote and votes against him and hands the company over to Lucas Mattson, Alexander Skarsgård's character, who then makes Tom, her husband, the CEO. She does this even after finding out that Lucas was going to make Tom the CEO anyway, even though he had lied to her and promised that she was going to make her the CEO.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of people online disappointed in her. They're disappointed in her, or they're saying, like, she got ultimate control, you know, like she has Tom's baby. She's going to be able to manipulate him from the sides. Everyone sounds stupid. Basically, she's a hater. She hated her brother. Yes, she didn't want him to win. And she took the vote away from him. And that's basically all that happened. And Jesse Armstrong, the creator of the series, I love that, like, he's finally, like, leaving some things up to ambiguity. But he was basically just like, she didn't want her brother to win. That's right, all there is. And I think this show is sort of emblematic of what was happening with Lost and, like, then The Sopranos and stuff like that, right? You know, like, people watch something and it's nice to have fan theories, but sometimes they get out of control and people start thinking that, like, everything is ambiguous or can be interpreted in some sort of weird, interesting way. And that's, like, that's just simply not true.
Mm-hmm. I think the show is always going to end with a Pyrrhic victory of some kind, too. So I think the kind of crestfallen way people feel about how it all broke down, I think secretly, if people think about it, they would realize that was inevitable. It was going to end with some sort of disappointment for somebody, since their quest is so horrible anyway, you know?
It was Kate Lear. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it started with Kendall, and it was always going to end with Kendall, who was the main character of the series. So let's get that into your heads, too. And then there's just also, I guess, this disappointment from people who are just sort of like sad when these people turn out to be horrible people. And it's like, what have you been watching? You can watch horrible people and relate to them, especially when it's a series that's gone on for 4 years. But, like, they're not going to all of a sudden, you know, become great, admirable people.
No, this is why the movie Young Adult is so good. She's terrible the entire time. And then there's a moment when she might become good. Nope, got even worse. Yeah.
I fucking love that movie so much.
I just watched it again when I was in D.C. a couple weekends ago. I don't know what possessed me, but man, it's so real. It so reminds you of people, which not every TV show or movie does.
I mean, speaking of just, like, Pride Month and gay shit, I mean, I want more gay Mavises.
Okay? As in,
from Young Adult. You know, like, I want, like, more gay characters in film and TV who feel like real people like that. Because you know what? we're horrible. You know,
and a lot desperate of us make decisions for high school exes. Yes.
A lot of us make decisions that are selfish. A lot of us make decisions that hurt other people. And I think that movie just feels so human and real to me in a way a lot of other movies don't. I mean, it's Diablo Cody's best film, as far as I'm concerned. And Jason Reitman's best film that he's ever directed. So
no, the way she casually lies about how amazing her career is to like people in her hometown, it's like pretty painfully apt. I mean, I think it's pretty funny.
And like obsessively thinking about her ex from high school by like continuing to play that song on loop in the tape deck, just opening up the movie like that. I'm like, it's beautiful to me.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad to think about that movie again. It really is fabulous. One of a kind.
Yeah. Well, that's our show this week. So thanks to Trace Lissette for joining us.
Thanks to Gay Pride for joining us.
Thanks to The Brick.
Thanks to The Brick.
Thanks to The Brick that hit Stonewall.
Her name is Laverne. No, go ahead. Yes.
By the way, I want to wrap this up with, there's a tweet from 2019, which I fucking love. This girl who tweeted it, at Pretty Boy Dad, was kind of dragged for this tweet back in 2019, but it resurfaced online recently with people saying, no, she was right.
Which is?
Stonewall, low-key, the worst gay bar ever. Can someone throw a brick at it again?
It's a smallish bar. Yeah. Yeah. Still there. Go ahead and walk on in.
Yeah. So if you're in New York, pick up a brick and throw it at Stonewall.
Join in. Yeah. Roland Emmerich style. Yeah.
We'll see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. And our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III and Louis Vertel.
This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to our digital team, Megan Patzel and Rachel Gajewski, and to Matt DeGroot and David Tolles for production support every week.
And as always, Keep It is recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.